Well, hi, friends, and welcome back to Sermon Smith. My name is John Chandler, and this is a podcast of conversations about the craft of sermon preparation. And with me today is my friend Wynn Collier. How are you, Wynn?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. I won't say that I went so far as to start this whole podcast just as an excuse to talk to you, but when I got back, you know, word from you that you wanted to be part of it, that was exciting to me because I always enjoy conversations with Wynn.
That's really kind. Thank you.
Yeah. So, Wynn, tell us where you are. Tell us about the context of the church you're in, where you preach.
Yeah. We live in Charlottesville, Virginia, and we are helping a new church form a little over five years old. It's All Souls Charlottesville, and we're probably maybe 180 people or so. We have a pretty wide range of ages, lots of kids, fair number of graduate students. The University of Virginia is here. We have a growing number of gray-haired heads, which I really love. And I would say we're slowly, very slowly, but are slowly growing in ethnic diversity, pretty incredibly diverse in almost every other way. And it's a pretty educated town. It's also a certain kind of artistic and bohemian culture here as well. And so there's a lot of creative types in our community. Fair number of, I only know to call them spiritual refugees. And those would be people who have some kind of spiritual background, but either have given up in the church or about to give up on the church or unsure anymore of what they think about God. So there's a lot of sort of ambiguity spiritually. There's we're a Eucharistically centered church. So we essentially follow the Book of Common Prayer. We orient our time and our disciplines around the church year. But we attempt to contextualize those things as well within the place where we are and the community where we are. So there's a fair bit of creativity as well. But that's maybe a little thumbnail sketch of yeah, our church.
And you... Well, probably about a month ago, I interviewed my friend Phil Nellis, who's up in Seattle, and he described himself as a Baptist who follows the lectionary and one of the only ones he knows. But my hunch is, I've talked to you about this before, and my hunch is this hasn't changed. Your church comes from a Baptist background, but you follow not just the calendar, but you follow the full lectionary each Sunday. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And I actually think there's a growing number of communities expressed in it in very different ways. But, you know, a lot of times when people think of Baptist, and I guess predominantly in our culture, you know, what you most think of is Southern Baptist.
Sure.
But there's a whole other host of kinds of Baptists, and many of them would be very closer to mainline. And so our church was birthed by the Baptist General Association of Virginia. I would say that personally, I feel more affinity both aesthetically, theologically, as a matter of disposition as an Anglican. So,
yeah. So how do you see, one more about context. What, how often do you preach?
I would say probably 70 to 75% of the time right now. In the last 4 months or so, it's been a little less because we're doing an extended season purposely covering both Lent and Easter on the around the issue of reconciliation as an imperative of God's kingdom. And because of that, we've had a number of other voices that we've brought in. So I've had a little bit more of a respite recently, but I would say ideally, I would actually hope for around 55, 60%.
Yeah. And which you've needed that respite a little bit amidst PhD work, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more here as we talk about how you work all this out alongside each other. But
sure.
When you say that you ideally would like to be 55-60%, is your goal that you would raise up other voices within All Souls or inviting other voices from the area, or what do you have in mind for that?
Yeah, I would say primarily, I'd say both, partly because I just think there's a certain kind of value to receiving the gifts that are outside your community. I know there's different ways of thinking about this, and I kind of grew up in a tradition where it was real common to have guest preachers or and some of that mentality was kind of like, bring in the guy who could sling the gospel gun kind of thing. And that whole idea I don't find to be particularly helpful, but recognizing that the body of Christ is incredibly diverse and that we need outside voices is something we want to continually have as a stream in our church. But primarily, I would say voices from within our church. And that's partly happening already through another pastor that we have. But also, we have begun a pastor-in-residence program. Mm. And this year, we had our first pastor-in-residence, and her name was Sarah Nell Hartman, and she actually is ordained in the PCUSA, but her husband was finishing his PhD work at the University of Virginia in religion, and she really did fill her call to pastoral life deepening, and so we knew we had her for a year left, and we brought her on as a pastor-in-residence, and we may not have a pastor in residence every year, but it is something that we are hoping to continue. And so that's another way that would happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what you just said about gunslingers of the gospel or something like that is a nice segue to the next question I was going to ask you, which is, how do you see the role of preaching fitting into the life of your congregation? Like, what role does it play, particularly on Sundays, but in your congregation overall?
Right. Well, in some ways, it's two things in opposite directions. There's a sense in which it plays less of a role than perhaps in some other traditions, and there's other sense in which it plays maybe more of a role. The less of a role is the fact that it's not the centerpiece of our worship. Hopefully, God is the center of our worship. Tongue in cheek a little bit there, but it seems like there is a subtlety here that as the human voice becomes more and more pronounced, I think it's quite possible that God's voice gets pushed to the side. And so, I say regularly, I could easily imagine a Sunday without a sermon. We've had them, and we'll again in the future. I cannot imagine a Sunday where the gospel is not preached through the Eucharist or through the reading of Scripture, through one another passing of peace to one another. So in that sense, things like my sermons have shortened over time. So
how long?
I would say probably about 20 minutes now.
Okay. Yeah.
A little bit more than an Anglican homily, but less than, the 40-minute sermon.
Less than a Baptist gospel singing, is that
forever? Yeah, and I am certainly not saying that all Baptists are that way. Just but in the other sense, the shortness of time doesn't in any way indicate less importance. I think it's an invitation to more succinct and focused declaration. And so I just think that if we're in this for the long haul, we don't have to pack mounds of information every week after week after week. But if we can fix our minds and our hearts and our attentions, even quietly sometimes, in something small and simple, and let it sort of sink in, that we may be doing ourselves better. But, something that probably will come up at some point if you ask the right questions, John.
no pressure.
It is just, for me, in my particular vocation, is I'm a writer, and it's really hard for me to tell oftentimes whether my writing life influences my pastoral life more or my pastoral life influences my writing life more. These are just interwoven. And I've noticed over time, at least when I'm thinking in terms of essays or just my writing is also becoming more shorter. And it's just something about not feeling like you have to say everything there is to say. And there's something about leaving space for the imagination and just offering an invitation to people that makes preaching more like spiritual direction, where you're not trying to tell people everything, but you're trying to let them encounter God. And I know that Eugene Peterson says our preaching these days suffers greatly from a lack of ambiguity. And we like to tell people too much. And I think that that's true in many of our art forms. And so all of that is a really long-winded way, which is totally going against what, what I'm just saying, but is a really long-winded way of saying that I think our preaching is very central, but not central perhaps in the ways I had learned previously to make it central, which was by giving it all the time and letting it eat up everything else, but instead letting it serve in a pivotal moment as the declarative encounter with the living word and letting it have its place alongside the entire Eucharist that's happening, that I think is a wider and broader way to understand it.
Talk briefly then about, because I happen to know that you grew up not too far from where I'm sitting right now, up the road in Waco, or at least you spent a good chunk of your years there. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. My dad's still a pastor in Waco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk a little bit about your journey from Southern Baptist to a love for the church calendar and a little bit more of a liturgical mindset.
Yeah. Well, I probably should clarify and say I actually didn't grow up Southern Baptist. I grew up Independent Baptist. And if you're familiar with that world, at least back in the 60s and 70s, to be Independent Baptist meant to think that the Southern Baptists were of the devil. So,
oh wow,
the Southern Baptists were the liberals.
You were not alive in the 60s.
I was born in 71.
Yes,
right. Yeah, but our history as Independent Baptists, you know, went all the way back to really the 40s and the 50s, and it's split with the SBC and all that sort of thing. I also would want to preface my answer by saying that. None of this is in any way a reflection on a judgment upon the very wonderful heritage I was given.
Sure.
I was taught to love God, that God loved me. I was handed a whole lot that has stayed with me. And my dad's been a pastor at Parkview Baptist Church in Waco, Texas for over 3 decades now. And that kind of longevity is so rare.
Yeah.
I have immense respect for that. So this is really more my own personal journey, and it's just, it's not, you know, maybe it's less of a leaving behind, more of a moving. But for me, I just encountered a lot of pain and a lot of questions and some real crisis of faith that didn't, you sort of last a week and move on. They really began to eat away at my soul. And for me, I found that I needed a faith that had richer and deeper roots in church history. And for me, it was a matter partly of community. We talked a lot about community, but the idea of community, that circle was drawn very tight around me and a few friends. Or me in my local church, and theologically, the deeply biblical resonance of community, which is the communion of saints, that this faith that I hold and the faith that I'm called to proclaim on a Sunday to God's people is not actually my faith. And it frankly doesn't matter a whole lot on a given Sunday how much I believe it. What I'm asked to do is together alongside God's community across time and history as a witness to, because I took vows I was ordained by God's church, and I took vows to declare the story that my foremothers and forefathers have declared. And there are days where I believe that incredibly strongly and powerfully, and there are days where I can't hardly make sense of it one whit. And on those days, I find all the more that what I do is I lean on the communion of saints. And I've made a promise. And I've made a promise to be faithful to that. And so the whole way of faith that has been handed down to us, and, you know, obviously you study church history for more than a minute. This isn't pure.
Sure.
But there are themes and there are continuities and there are boundaries. And there are witnesses and there are councils and that all of these things matter and they mean something. And I also needed a faith that just didn't depend on my sort of fickled emotions and whatever my issue of the week is or whatever it might be. And I needed a faith that didn't just sort of depend on my discipline. I needed a faith that was bigger, a lot bigger than me, to carry me. And for me, theologically, experientially, aesthetically, communally, all these things just made sense in some of our older traditions. And in some ways, I feel like it saved me. And so that's the pastor I've become.
Yeah. And it's rich for you and full.
Yeah, it is.
Most of the time.
It's not perfect. Yeah, it's not perfect. Yeah. But yeah.
So you talked a little bit ago about me asking the right questions and about writing, and I'm seeing on your bookshelf behind you, because every time I do one of these interviews and somebody has their bookshelves behind them, I get distracted because I'm trying to make out book titles. But I do see there's one that I recognize, which is The Pastor, Eugene Peterson's memoir back there, right?
Right. That's right.
Yeah. And so I remember he kind of interacted with that idea a little bit about the relationship between being a pastor and a writer. I feel like there's a quote that's on the tip of my brain, tip of something in my head, where he talks specifically about the relationship between writing and pastoring. So talk a little bit more. We'll get into your timeline about how you develop sermons here in a bit, but these are fresh on my mind, these questions. So talk a little bit about that. Like, what do you see as the relationship between the writing that you do and the pastoring that you do, whether it's pastoring holistically as a, you know, pastor in the church, or whether it's just the sermon part?
Yeah. And I think it's all the above. I think, you know, Eugene Peterson and Wendell Berry and probably Will Willimon are the ones who've most helped me, be a better pastor. I don't know exactly, other than to say they helped me see the world differently. You know, if I were a business executive, I could probably say the same kind of things. I think business executives face some of the same pressures that pastors do these days, which is to sell our soul in order to survive and to find our identity and our meaning in making things grow and making things work. And it all sounds grand. And it's beautiful when it works and it feels really good. But there are definitely days where I sit back and I wonder if what we're selling ourselves to isn't something that ultimately is going to destroy us. And so, you know, I think you and I have talked about this before, actually, but I think fiction really helps me to not – it's hard to talk about this in ways that don't just sound utilitarian. It's not like they give me better illustrations for sermons, or they just help me to write a better sermon, you know, because I pay attention to the craft of words. That definitely is part of it, but it's something else. It's something that I don't really have language for yet. I think maybe it's this. Maybe that in our day and time, our sermons and our pastoring have become too utilitarian, and they've become too consumed by models of leadership and growth and humanity that are just so foreign to the Bible and to Jesus. And so maybe we have to find other places of incarnation that remind us of what the Bible and Jesus have been all along, which is, you know, Wendell Berry, you can't walk away from that without getting a sense of place and neighborhood and individual relationships and reverence for things that are holy. Mm-hmm. And so, I just think that I see those things, really intertwined. And, I don't know that I'm answering your question very well, but that's
still good stuff. I'm enjoying
I think I'm going to have to stop because I don't know that what else to say.
Fair enough. Let's talk then about how you put a sermon together from the time. Obviously, I mean, I imagine if you're using the lectionary, you have something defined for you every time. But talk about how you approach from, you know, these four texts that are assigned each Sunday, where you pick it up from there, and just walk through your timeline of putting together a sermon.
Right. Well, we don't always preach from the lectionary. We always read the lectionary.
Okay.
So
all four texts every Sunday?
Not necessarily.
All right.
We almost always read the first reading, the Old Testament reading or Hebrew reading. We always read the gospel reading and stand to hear it. And we almost always read the epistle reading. We, for our litanies, three times out of the month, those are written by a litany team in our church. The fourth Sunday, we use a psalm as the litany. So that's typically the flow that we have right now. So as we look out sort of over where our community is and, there are times where we will do a topical series. We sort of have three streams of preaching. We preach directly from the lectionary. We preach series based upon where our community's life is. So, for instance, as I mentioned earlier, we're doing a series on reconciliation right now. And then we actually, probably in the fall, we'll be doing a series on the Apostles' Creed. And actually this summer, we're going to do a book of the Bible just because we haven't done one in about a year and a half. And we feel like we really need to. We're going to do Philippians.
Yeah.
So all of that makes it sound like we hardly ever preach in the lecture, but we do actually a whole lot. And almost always during the high moments of the church season, so Advent, most, you know, a lot of times during Lent, and then lots of times throughout the year we'll do that. So now do you want me to answer the question about when we're preaching from the lectionary or when we're not?
Whatever's freshest to you right now. If you're doing a series right now, you could talk through that.
Yeah. Well, honestly, the pattern is pretty much the same.
Yeah.
The pattern is I'll start to think about it always by Wednesday. If I can at least start to meditate on the text on Tuesday, that's always helpful. If it is a time where we're preaching through the lectionary, most often I will just simply read the text and I will pay attention to where my heart is quickened or where I have a real question rise up.
Only one?
Well, hoping that there's at least one that seems really powerful or important. And if it's more of a series or a book of the Bible, then the text will already have been laid out for me ahead of time. And I will just sort of soak in that and try to get the questions ruminating, maybe try to read it before I go running or something, and just let my mind wander and meditate on that. And perhaps write down a few questions that it raises for me or places of confusion, or if something seems sort of striking to me, maybe like would strike you, like if you were reading it in Lectio Divina or something, just sort of writing that down. And then on Wednesday, I try to usually put a chunk of time on Wednesdays for sermon preparation, and that's when I usually read commentators, other sermons. And I kind of view that as my conversation partners. I love the idea when people talk about a group of pastors meeting perhaps once a month, and they'll all talk over upcoming texts that will be preached through. I don't have the benefit of that right now. And so I view these other things I read in that way. How do they spur my imagination? Where do they challenge me? Where do they raise questions that I think I would have, or people that in my community would be wrestling with? Where's a phrase that just strikes me that I can't sort of drop? And then on Thursday is really the meat of my day. That's the day I set aside. Don't do any appointments or anything like that. It's just a day for sermon craft. And so I will usually do a little bit more reading in the morning, or maybe when on my run that morning, I really will start to think what shape this is taking. And then I just set to the keyboard and I just start typing. And this is where maybe the confluence of my two vocations sort of collide, in that at that moment, in many ways, it does feel more like I'm just writing. And I'm seeing where it takes me, and I'm seeing what shape it takes. And I begin to sort of play with it as I go. And I'm hopeful that by 3 o'clock on Thursday, I have something down that seems at least workable.
And when you say you start writing, almost like free form, just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, free form, but I mean, I'm actually filling up my page of notes that I will use.
Right.
And my notes are somewhere between a manuscript and scribble.
Okay.
And
that's a broad range.
It is. Yeah. And I would say over time, I would say it's becoming to look a little bit more like manuscript. But it's not exactly a manuscript. And so then I put it away, and I really don't look at it Friday and Saturday. Friday is our Sabbath. Saturday is just a family day. And I'll, you know, get up early on Sunday, and I'll work with it some more and see what makes sense to me then, and where does it feel dead, where does it feel alive. And that's kind of it.
So that's, I assume, an early morning on Sunday while the house is still quiet. Right.
Yep. Coffee's brewing, house is quiet. Yep.
So I assume Monday is a work day for you, but yes. You just don't touch it on Monday.
No, I'm trying to work toward a 2.5-day work week, but I haven't gotten there yet. So
how's that going?
I'm still working on it.
So you talked about, you know, Tuesday is really just some initial rumination. Wednesday you get into study, you know, other voices, whether primarily you said other commentators or other sermons.
Yeah.
Do you tend to go back to the same ones? Do you, depending on what series you're in, pick up some favored commentaries or anything like that? Or where do you draw them from?
Yeah. And, you know, and just if I think that you heard me right, but I just want to make sure, because I know that I've heard a lot of people talk about sermon preparation, and it sounds incredibly idyllic and over, like, I think I could never do that. You know, two things I would just want to say is my way is just like, it's just my way. And
everybody's way is their way. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And the second thing is, you know, on that Tuesday, for instance, when I say rumination, I mean, I'm talking about 15 minutes.
Right.
You know? So anyway, I once heard John MacArthur talking, and he said that he spends 30 hours every week in sermon preparation. And I remember thinking how ridiculous that is. And I think I still would agree. So books. Well,
and I'll say this. I mean, you say 15 minutes, but it's also then just kind of kicking around in your brain for the next 24 hours. So
yeah,
kickstarting something.
That's right. I think that's the way I work. Is that I just need it to be bounced around in my head, and then paying attention to what's going on around me and seeing where my world and the text collide. So, there's a few things I use regularly. If I'm preaching through the lectionary, I really like the Feasting on the Word lectionary commentary series.
Huh.
It follows; it's now completed, and it does the whole 3-year cycle, and each volume has every text for the Sunday, And then it has four different responses to each text. There's a theological perspective, a pastoral perspective, an exegetical perspective, and a homiletical perspective. And it's not technical. It's and there's all kinds of voices. I mean, there's probably a couple hundred contributors to the volume.
Wow, that's great.
And there are definitely weeks where, you know, it seems far less potent than others.
Sure.
But it's just a good orientation to it. And so that's one place. I almost always just start with N.T. Wright's little For Everyone series.
Yeah.
Very simple, very easy, but theologically attuned, obviously. And I feel like it's just a good starting point to just sort of ground myself in it, to see what N.T. sees. And partly it's just because I like N.T. a lot. But it can also be really frustrating because every section he opens up, you know, with a story.
Right.
It sometimes feels connected, sometimes doesn't. It feels like he's trying too hard every once in a while. But also it gets frustrating just because, given the brevity and the sort of popular nature of it, I mean, there'll be these just huge questions that don't even get touched on. So if I'm in an Old Testament text, I'll almost always go to Brueggemann. If I'm in a New Testament text, it just really depends. You know, I really like the Brazos Theological Commentaries. I like them because they look at text theologically as opposed to sort of parsing every single syllable. And I just sometimes find that really helpful because I'm almost always going to be reading them alongside a technical commentary.
Yeah.
Or two or three. And sometimes you can just really get lost in the forest. And so I like that. And then, I'll look for poetry that reflects on those themes or,
Wendell Berry again.
Wendell Berry. Yeah. I love short stories. I as much as I can, I like to go to the ancient Christian commentary on scripture.
Yeah.
Cause I think it's a problem that we always tend to look at these texts and we don't go any further back than Luther or Calvin, which might be a problem.
Or sometimes we don't go further back than the 70s or 80s.
Yeah, that's right.
Because newer is always better, yeah.
That's right. We don't go further back than N.T. Wright, right. So that's kind of probably a general flow.
So as I'm talking to you and you're answering this question, you're glancing all over your bookshelves. So I take it you're all about physical books. You're not a Bible software guy.
Okay. Well, that's probably true. But I do use Logos.
Yeah.
I use it mainly for word studies. I use it for most of the language tools. I rarely crack my Hebrew Bible. I never crack my Hebrew Bible. I rarely crack my Greek New Testament. I almost always do it in the language tools at Logos. And what else? And I have migrated some of my the Word Biblical Commentary series.
Yeah.
I was able to get a real still on that through Logos, and I'm running out of bookshelf. So I will actually say it is true that reference books, I've bitten the apple, and I am migrating reference stuff like the Feasting on the Word series I told you about. More recently, I've actually been buying the new Kindle version of those. So,
gotcha.
Yeah, I'm not a Luddite.
And that gets traumatic too, because then you decide, well, this is available in Kindle, but all my other resources are in Logos. Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
So the word study type stuff, I assume that happens on Wednesday as well. Alongside commentary.
Actually, no. I would say that happens more often on Thursday as I'm writing.
Okay.
Because as I'm reading on Wednesday, what I'm mostly doing is noting things that I want to be – it's almost like if I were writing a novel, I would have – some notes down about characters and some scenes I've thought of. And it's really just material that when I get to the keyboard, it's like my clay. And it's where I start to see where it takes me. And so when I read, it's more like that. When I'm looking for a word study, usually that's me trying to answer a question, or it's me trying to see where it's going to take me. And so that's a little bit more narrow and focused. And I'm trying to answer a specific question or wrestle with one particular idea or understand a phrase. And so that's more happening as I'm typing away and sort of molding this thing.
Yeah. Okay. And so you just answered another question. I was going to start leaning into Thursday now. And I was imagining you would be a handwriter, but you just said as you sit down at the keyboard. So you just sit down and start hammering away all these ideas on Word?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where, as you're doing commentary study, do you have Word open and you're capturing thoughts in there as well?
No, actually, I typically am marking in my book.
Yeah.
Sometimes I will have a legal pad, and that's will be handwriting. I'll write some notes on Wednesday, and then maybe set that beside me, and I'm working from that. If I can mix metaphors, then at that point it becomes like my palette. And I use that as I'm writing.
And you said that when you get to Thursday, hopefully by 3,
right?
The way that you described it to me, it still felt like what you had some degree of ambiguity to it, which we know from earlier in this conversation, you're comfortable with some ambiguity,
right?
So does Thursday at 3 p.m. feel finished to you, or do you feel like you have to have that Sunday morning time to really pull it all together?
Yes, both. There are times where the day is magical, and Thursday at 3, it just feels like, and for me, it's just an intuition. It's like there is a oomph there, and something feels really alive to me. A lot of times I say, I'll go in, Miska will often be in the kitchen, and I'll say, well.
Your wife.
Yes, my wife. I'll say, well, I got some words on a page. And that's probably the majority of how it feels. And then Sunday morning is me coming back to it and saying, okay, I think best I know, I've done the work I'm to do. And now I am really watching, and I would hope that this is paying attention to the spirit. I'm really watching for where is this sing? Where is this alive? Where is there some fire? Where is there a deep quietness in the sermon? And that may mean that I cut stuff at that point, or I reshape. It may mean that sometimes it's none of that, and I just feel like, wow, okay, then this is what I have to give, and I trust that that's enough. So no, normally Sunday morning is really crucial. There are occasions, and they're beautiful when they happen, though rare, where it just feels like Sunday morning is really just a reconnection.
I'm getting stressed thinking about how my Friday and Saturday would go if I didn't feel like if I did the schedule you did and felt like,
yeah,
this gap between Thursday and Sunday, and Sunday I really have to pull it all together. I'm just like, my hair's falling out just thinking about what my Friday and Saturday would feel like.
Yeah. And I get that. And sometimes I wonder why I don't feel that more. I don't know. Some of it may be personality. Some of it may be that it's happened enough times that I now have just realized this is just how it works. And I have somehow learned in my little mind to just trust it. Some of it may also be just the longer I'm a pastor of these people.
Yeah.
I just realize more and more I don't have to say very much. I think it would feel different if I felt like I really had to deliver a lot of poignant content that was going to zing every Sunday. But on those Sundays where I just feel like, man, this is really simple, I don't have a whole lot, I've learned, and I guess our church is letting me be okay with, like, okay, well, that's what it is. And that must mean that right now this is all we need. And if I get up there for 8 minutes and I remind them that God loves them, and that God is creating beautiful things in our world, and that we can trust God, and that life is a gift, that's enough. And, you know, it's pretty easy to say those things regularly from the scripture. And, you know, I probably don't have a whole lot of different things to say. And so, yeah.
As you, as you're tying it all together, some on Thursday, some on Sunday, and you said you work towards somewhere between manuscript and nothing.
Chicken scratch.
How much do you find on Sunday morning you're actually referring? Do you print it out? Do you have it on an iPad? Okay, so how much do you find you're actually referring to that while you preach, or do you just feel like by that time it's kind of internalized?
Yeah. I would say the older I get, the more I use my notes. It's something like, I mean, I would call it something like a very enlivened book reading. It's kind of like when I would go to a bookshop and do a little reading from a chapter.
Yeah.
I mean, I know those chapters pretty well after I've spent lots of time in them. And, but I do, I mean, I'm reading it, but I'm also, but it feels kind of enlivened. It's not like my nose is buried in my notes. But I'm definitely, I'm relying on them.
Yeah.
If I lost them, and it's happened before, you know, then I definitely could still continue the sermon, but I know 100% it would look a lot different, and I would trust that too. But I use my notes a good bit.
Yeah. So how do you evaluate it on whether that be Thursday or Sunday? Are there questions? excuse me. Are you questions you ask to feel like, okay, I know this is ready, or is there a certain structure format you follow for how you construct your thoughts every time, or anything like that?
Not really. I mean, there is a movement at the end of the sermon, which is a question for response. It's sort of treating the sermon itself like a litany, and it's allowing the people to respond. Typically it's quietly in their own heart, but I will leave a question or something. But I wouldn't necessarily say that's a signal that it's done. That's just more of like, that is the conclusion. For me, it's more an intuitive thing. And honestly, there are many Sundays where it doesn't feel done. I mean, I think that's kind of the point is, I think I'm a little suspicious when our sermons always feel done. I'm not sure I trust that. And that can become more and more a kind of production that's disconnected from the actual life of my community. And so that's actually one thing I love about preaching through books of the Bible and the places in the lectionary when you're just sort of following a text along is it's really wonderful when the conclusion of your sermon really is no conclusion at all. It's like, we'll continue this conversation next week. And, but for me, as far as when I feel like I'm at the place where I'm to stop preparation, maybe that's a way I would put it. But that's often, just a sense of intuition of, I mean, sometimes it's time. Okay. I have no more time unless I want to take time away from my family. I'm not going to do that. I'm done.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's okay. It feels whole. It feels alive. And I feel like to say anything more would actually detract. And so when we reach that point, then I stop.
You are a writer. I think it's a safe guess that you are also a reader, an active reader. Certainly you've talked about fiction, but I imagine you read a fair bit. As you come across things that you go, I want to engage with this in a future sermon. It might be something that you're writing and you say, oh, this is something that I could bring to our congregation. But certainly that happens when you're reading, I would imagine.
Right.
Do you have any kind of system for how you tuck those ideas away?
Yeah, and I need a better one. I have, Let's see.
Everybody's embarrassed to answer this question. Oh, my system's so bad.
Yeah. Well, part of it is I have a great idea for a system, and I want to make some money with it. I want to build an app that is really tailored to first to preachers and to writers, and I think there's a lot of overlap there.
Sure.
And what I currently do is I use the Bento program.
Yeah.
To keep quotes and stories and prayers. And I also have a little note file, which is incredibly inefficient, but just a really long note file in Notes on Mac. And I think there's also I have a file somewhere in Evernote. And, I would say, maybe this is another, goes back to a much earlier question. I would say those things that I land in those things, actually, I first think of them as things I will write about. But here's the deal. I just don't know that I separate that. When I think about writing, it's, writing articles, writing a book, writing a sermon. I just don't know that I separate those things a whole lot. And so, it's probably actually pretty rare that I see something, hear something, watch something, and think that needs to be in a sermon. I usually just think of it a little more generally. If that's something that's really important, and I'm going to return to that, and then it may be in a story, it may be in a book, it may be in a sermon, it may just be in a conversation. And actually, can I ask you one question?
You can ask anything. I might not answer.
What is the, as you have,
you're the subject.
As you've had these conversations with different people, what has been the most intriguing or, like, to you, most helpful system you've run across?
I think the one that's still the most fascinating to me is AJ Swoboda. You know AJ,
uh-huh.
I'd imagine.
Yeah.
AJ, a lot of people are dissatisfied with their system. A lot of people have fairly ambiguous systems or just good memories. AJ has created a document for every pericope of scripture on his laptop.
Wow.
Like a Word document. And so anytime he runs across something in reading or something like that, he'll just pull up that document for John 1, 1 through 8 or whatever it is, and put those ideas in there so that when he comes to a text, he's almost built his own little.
Wow.
I don't have the time to put into that. I think there's other ways that you could do something similar, and I've tried to do something similar. But, yeah, I thought it was I think back to his a lot.
Well, it's interesting, and I should call him up, see if this would help him. I think you could almost do that in Bento, because what I've done is I've created a section that is for liturgy, and I connect it to what cycle of scripture it's in. And I feel like all you'd have to do is add a field and connect it to a particular text, and you could have that whole thing filterable and everything. Interesting.
You could do it in something like Evernote with tags and stuff, too. I've started to try to do something similar to that.
Yeah.
You know that they stopped making Bento, and they're not going to keep developing it.
Oh, really? Is there something replacing it?
Scary news. No, I think it's... I mean, it was made by FileMaker, which Apple, I think, owns as a subsidiary or something. So I think they were just felt like FileMaker covered most of what they needed. I'm not sure, or if it just wasn't
interesting,
bought enough. But
well, maybe you and I should go into product mode together and build this app.
Sounds a little overwhelming. all right, what else? I had another question for you, and it just escaped me. I know what it was. And we're starting to wind down on time here, but I jotted this down at the very beginning, and I want to ask this. You talked about how All Souls has a fair amount of spiritual refugees or something. I don't remember the exact term that you used.
Yeah, who's it?
How do you feel like you've had to learn how to preach in light of that crowd, or do you feel like that crowd has come because of the way you preach? And the real point behind that question is, what do you think it is about your preaching that you do that appeals to people who might be suspicious in most other contexts?
I first would say, I think there's definitely other places they could have gone as well. I think that I think there is, the people like that do find a certain resonance with me, because I feel like I get that and am often there myself.
It's part of the journey, yeah.
Right, yeah. So I think I, in some ways, it just is no surprise to me. I think it would be, just as a sidelight, this might be interesting if you ever run out of, or want to take a little break from this series of podcasts, it might be interesting to return to interview one person in or two people in each congregation of the pastors you talk to and just get their, like, their take on their pastor's preaching. Interesting. Because I think I'd love to know. But, I mean, if I were to say what I've heard and the sense I get, I think there's a couple words that I hear a lot, is that there's a spaciousness to all souls worship in general. And I think that is reflecting the preaching as well, that just gives people a lot of room. Another word I hear a lot of is safety, that they feel safe emotionally, and I think too that there's a kind of open-handedness that can come when you begin to believe that what people need is God, that you, the preacher, are not God, that you're just a witness to that, that can, and if you're not trying to force people into some position, decision, to sign up for something, to be somewhere that they're not, if what you really want for them is for them to encounter the living God, there's really no place for badgering or bullying or power manipulation. And I think part of it for me is I've taken, just the long view of all this, and that I don't know, where people are going to be next year, but I at least have a vision for where they could be 20 years from now. And I believe a lot in the incarnation and what that says about the goodness of humanity and our humanness. And I think too much preaching works from the posture that our humanness is what needs to be beaten out of us. And I think there's a resonance with people that they find a God who's other and transcendent, but who is also one who they don't need to surrender their identity and their sense of themselves to follow this God. And I think that just creates an environment where people can trust again and slowly begin to move and be challenged. And at least I hope that's what's happening.
Yeah. A question I like to ask towards the end. Books. You've talked about some study resources and all that. That's great. But books that you feel like have helped form you as a preacher, they might be preaching related, they might not, that you think would be helpful for others. He looks really, to his bookshelf again.
Yeah. I really like reading Buechner's sermons. I think he's really, I just love his sermons. Will Willimon, his book, The Pastor, although now I'm second guessing myself because I know this is Peterson's memoir, and I think it's the same title though. I think it's The Pastor.
I'm trying to remember, yeah.
I mean, he talks a lot about preaching in there, and that's, Will Willimon, he, that's kind of his gig, is preaching, and he's good at it. This one is definitely the pastor is the predominant word in it. I think it's just the pastor. It may just be pastor. So those are probably the books if I'm thinking about actually preaching. And of course, Brueggemann has some good things to say about the prophetic act of preaching.
Anything in particular? Like, how you leaning towards the prophetic imagination or something?
Yeah. I'm thinking prophetic imagination. And I love reading Hauerwas's sermons. He's got a new one out that you may have seen. Just came out on Sermons for Christ Church as a subtitle. I don't remember the main title.
Writing these down. so I can link to them on the website. All right, one last one. You write. Tell us a little bit about your own books or other things. Have you written anything? You're working on a PhD, so I don't know that you might have a book in progress right now, but talk a little bit about some of the writing you've done.
Yeah. So I'm a freelance writer. So I write a number of articles and that sort of thing. So that's sort of just a help pay the bills kind of deal. And then I've written three books so far, and the first one is called Restless Faith, and it's kind of emerged out of one of my sort of long dark crisis of faith, and then my second book was called was on Francois Fenelon, and he was a French mystic priest in the 17th century, and he was a spiritual director to a number of younger Christians serving in King Louis' court, and it's a series of letters. And I sort of refreshed those, and then we don't have the letters that were written to him, we just have his responses. So I've set those in a context of what it seems like the questions were, and I just find that to be a really warm and personal place of spiritual guidance.
You didn't say the title, but that's Let God. Am I remembering the right title?
Oh, that's right. It's called Let God, the Transforming Wisdom of Francois Fenelon. It's under another title on the Kindle version. For the life of me, at this moment, I can't even remember it. But the third book, the last one, was called Holy Curiosity, Encountering Jesus's Provocative Questions. And in some ways, this probably wouldn't quite, maybe just a follow-up in some ways to Restless Faith, because in Restless Faith, I was in that moment of just getting really honest about my own questions. And, that's become very in vogue in Christian writing. But with the Holy Curiosity, it was as if I recognized that the God had some of his own questions. And it was like, okay, you've aired them, I've heard them, and I really do receive them. I would like you to have a sit down, because I have some questions to pose you. And I reflected on the fact that how many times in the Gospels Jesus doesn't give people an answer, he asks them a question. And so I took eight of those questions and just reflected on them. And more recently, I've been working on kind of a fiction thing set with a series of pastoral letters that a pastor is writing to his congregation. And it sort of narrates some stories, and I was talking to a publisher. I'm not really sure where that's going, and I am in the middle of PhD work, so I'm not sure if that's going to move forward in the near term. But as soon as I get finished with this PhD, I will quickly and eagerly return to my truer love, which is more writing.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Somebody wants to keep track of what's happening with you online. Mention what's the URL for your blog, the church's website. You tweet.
Very rarely. wincollier.com.
Yeah.
It's wincollier.com. And our church is all souls, souls, Seville, CVILLE.com. And Twitter is just wincollier. Facebook, all those wonderful, deadly things.
Yeah, and you do. I admire between the PhD work and the sermons that you're talking about, you put out some pretty thoughtful reflections on your blog that I really appreciate. So I don't know how the heck you work those in, but you do.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Wynn, it's been a pleasure. I knew I would enjoy this conversation, and I certainly did.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's really generous of you.
Yeah.
Okay.
And blessings.
Thank you.